We now join the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the COVID pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Tom Locke and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
So bifurcating the lease would be a short-term solution to a longer-term issue.
And telling someone that has a big tent that's been expanding, you're no longer just camping protected by the eviction moratorium. Now you're in an emergency shelter and you can't have that giant tent is a really challenging challenging thing to make happen. So I think there's challenges in not reciting it if we're going to change the disposition of that population and the oversight.
Okay, thank you. And I just realized that it's 9:45 already.
So. Sorry, I took all your time again.
Well, that's okay. We'll resume briefing after we hear from Dr. Locke and Willie Bentz. Welcome. Hope you had a nice weekend. What do you have for us today?
Good morning. Yes, it was a lovely weekend. Got a lot of biking in. Looking at the COVID epidemiology this week, we continue to see a very welcome drop in cases nationally, down another 18%, and very significant drops in hospitalization and death rates, over 20% drop in each of those markers. So nationally, we're down to about 15,000 new cases of COVID every day, which would, most countries, this would seem like a huge amount. But in the United States, this is a dramatic drop from the days when we were having 300,000 new cases in a day. We did pass a grim milestone last week, where they're now officially over 600,000 deaths from COVID-19. This is getting close to the 650,000 people who were thought to have died in the 1918 influenza pandemic. There's studies that suggest that this number may be a dramatic undercount. When you factor in other things, the true death rate may be as high as 900,000 people in the U.S. Nationally, vaccination rates are slowing. We haven't gotten back to the peak vaccination levels that we had in April, and the vaccine uptake is really varies across the country. So some states where less than 25% are vaccinated, these are mostly southern states, and it has real national impact in that these are the places where we most expect the epidemic to pick up again. Nationally, we're about 45% of Americans are now fully vaccinated, and the number's better for those over 65. It's 77%. Here in Washington, we're seeing cases continue to drop, not as fast as the rest of the country, but down 32% over the last 2 weeks. And hospitalizations and death rates are also dropping significantly. So those are all really good signs. But in terms of activity level, Washington State has the 10th highest level of the states in the nation. Our vaccination levels are higher than the national average. So 52% of Washingtonians are fully vaccinated. And in the over 65 age group, it's 84%. So that's a really good target. And probably one of the big reasons that our hospitalization and death rates are dropping is we've done such a good job in getting our elderly population vaccinated. The folks at the state are watching the vaccination, a particular vaccination statistic, which is the first dose in those 16 years of age and older, because if that reaches 70%, then the governor will rescind his various COVID restrictions before June 30th. And that figure is at 67.8% as of Friday. But the state actually now has a website called Path to 70%, where they're tracking that statistic on a daily basis. And it looks like if it does hit 70%, it will be pretty close to the end of the month. So we're still expecting that as the time when all the different capacity limits on restaurants and movie theaters and most other places and events will end. Jefferson County, we've had an increase in cases. Over the 2 weeks ago, the week that began 2 weeks ago, we had 14 cases. Fortunately, last week it was a little less than that. It dropped to 8 cases. So 22 cases over the last 2 weeks, which is a case rate of 69 per 100,000. And it was 56.4 in the prior recording period. So we've gone up. Clallam County has experienced a very similar thing. So they're at 83 cases per 100,000. And Kitsap is actually the lowest of the three counties now. So they've dropped to 62 cases per 100,000, which is significant, because in the past, we've seen a lot of our exposures come from Kitsap County. So the exposure risk in Kitsap is dropping. And Clallam in Jefferson, we were sort of comparing our cases last week, and very, very similar patterns. We're seeing clusters in unvaccinated individuals with high, what we call attack rates. So the number of people in a household who get infected, and they're linked to indoor gatherings. So unmasked indoor gatherings. And we expect, unfortunately, that this is gonna be a pattern throughout the summer, is that when unvaccinated people get together, especially in indoor spaces, they should be reminded that they still are required by a Secretary of Health order to wear a mask in those settings, but whether they'll actually do it or not is an open question. Vaccination rates in Jefferson County are still among the highest in the state. We now have measures of total population 16 and above, and 12 and above is the newest measure that's been added. And that's an interesting one. So if we look at everyone who's eligible for the vaccine, 12 and above, 72.3% have had at least one dose, and almost 69% are fully vaccinated. And we're also, from the state websites, we can now break out vaccination levels based on different age bands. And our highest age band is among those 65 and older, where 86% are fully vaccinated, or actually 86% have had at least one dose. And then it kind of drops with age. So when we get down to the 18 to 34 age group, about 57% have had a first dose. And then the newest added group is 12 to 17%. And that group, 38% of adolescents and teens have had at least one dose. And that's really pretty good, given the fact that we've just started outreach and vaccinating that age group. So I'm encouraged by that. And then the one other thing cover by way of report, we had a report on the variants from the Department of Health on Friday, and their Department of Health is doing this ongoing genetic sequencing of positive COVID tests, but it's a slow process. So the data we get lags by about 3 weeks behind what's really going on. So the data we now have for the end of May is showing a real shift in the variants in Washington State. So what's now known as the Alpha variant and previously was called the UK variant, that's dropping in frequency. So it's down to, it was down to 54% of cases at the end of May, and the is probably down even a bit more now. What's increasing and is concerning is the Gamma variant, which was previously known as the Brazilian origin variant. That's increased to 16.4% of the variant samples. And that's one of the highest rates in the US, or highest percentages, and very likely linked to our proximity to British Columbia, because this is the variant that's been causing a lot of outbreak activity in BC. And then the other variant that's going up is the now what's now known as the Delta variant, which is of originated in India. And it is up to 6% of the isolates. And nationally, it's the one that's really surging. And as we look at all these different variants, the things they have in common, they're all more infectious than the prior strains. They're all vaccine sensitive, fortunately. So they're prevented by the vaccine. But for several of them, it appears that you need a high antibody level to successfully be protected. So it's important that everyone who's getting a two-dose vaccine series make sure and get the second dose, because it's the second dose that gives you a really high antibody level. And then one of the reasons we're carefully tracking the Gamma variant is that of all the variants, it's the one that seems to cause more serious disease. So we're now seeing an increase in hospitalization rates in Washington State of people who have the Gamma variant. So that's the one that is truly more virulent, is the name we use medically for strains of bacteria or viruses that are cause more harm. It was interesting. One of the KPTZ questions asked, why are variants more infectious? And that's a subject of intense research, which is unlocking some of the reasons behind it. And it seems to fall into two main categories. One is the variants have different kinds of spike protein. So the spike protein on the virus has changed, and the spike protein is what allows coronavirus to attach to and invade our cells. So the better that spike protein is at attaching to cells, the more successful it is in getting into our bodies. And so the variants have a sort of an improved spike protein design, at least from the virus's standpoint. And then the other thing they're finding in research is some of the newer variants are able to temporarily suppress the body's immune response to the virus, what's called innate immunity. Anytime we get infected with a virus, our body starts to react almost immediately with this kind of non-specific response. It's something that anyone who's had the vaccine has had a taste of what innate immunity feels like, because that's where the side effects of the vaccine come from. That fever, soreness, or queasy feeling is your innate immunity kicking in. And some of the variants appear to be able to suppress that. And so the virus is able to multiply more rapidly. And what that translates into is then people who are infected with a variant have more of the virus in their system, and they are more contagious. When they breathe or cough or sing in an indoor space, they release more virus into the environment. So that seems to be the mechanism of increased infectiousness. And Commissioner Brotherton.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Locke. Those are good explanations. I was wondering if there was also a possibility that if a variant was less infectious, it wouldn't thrive. So we're only seeing the most successful variants at spreading, you know, as opposed to those that are going to go away if they aren't as infectious as the original.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's really a kind of an evolutionary competition between the different variants. And in fact, viruses are mutating all the time, and the overwhelming majority of mutations are unfavorable for the virus. They make it less able to infect people. So it's only these very rare mutations that are beneficial that we eventually know about and become a problem. But it's this virus is showing more capacity to mutate into more infectious forms than we originally thought it would. We used to think coronaviruses didn't have a lot of capability to do that. And now we're discovering, unfortunately, that's incorrect.
Just to follow up, we had public comment today talking about how the variants are only 0.3% different than the original, and that's not very much. Can you parse that into common sense language, why either that's not a significant statistic or isn't true, or just kind of give us a little bit of background for it?
I can't confirm. I haven't actually seen the percentage difference, but 0.3 would be more than enough. If you're just looking at tiny alterations of the spike protein to make it a better fit into the receptor on our cells that it attaches to. And then that viruses developing these proteins that can inhibit our immune system. So typically more virulent strains of infection only have tiny differences, but it's enough to translate into big differences in terms of spread. And the thing we're really concerned about with variants is a variant that might emerge that is vaccine resistant. That has not happened yet, but it's one of the many reasons we've got to do a better job globally of getting the pandemic under control. So that's have some KPTZ questions. Although I hopefully I answered one already, but open it up to the commissioners.
I uncharacteristically don't have any today. How about you, Heidi?
My only, I think I said this last week, is I feel I'm sensing confusion over the CDC guidance. There's still, you know, that happened a couple of weeks ago. There's like things take a while, and there's still confusion about, you know, why are we still masking? And I've been telling everyone we have our separate masking ordinance, and you know, but I don't know if you see anything on the horizon that's going to shift again to cause more confusion. Just trying to anticipate what to prepare for.
Yeah, I don't think the CDC is going to change their guidelines anytime soon. They received a lot of criticism for, you know, how it was rolled out, but I think the science-based guidance right now is embodied in the Secretary of Health's directive, which it's our plan that, you know, within now, you know, a week and a half, everyone in the state will all be following the same guidance. And it's essentially, if you're unvaccinated, you need to continue to wear a mask indoors, but no one else does. So although there's one nuance to it, this is not contained in the Secretary of Health's guidance, but in the CDC still recommends that fully vaccinated people who are indoors with someone who is unvaccinated and at high risk of COVID complications, you still should wear a mask. And the idea there is, you know, even if you're fully vaccinated, you could get a low-grade infection and spread it to that person who's unvaccinated and at risk of serious complications. But from a legal standpoint, it's still going to be a requirement that people who are unvaccinated wear masks in indoor settings. But enforcement is something that is always the question. And by and large, I think it will be an honor system, or it'll be up to businesses or public venues. Anyone who wants to verify vaccination status has an absolute legal right to do so. But how much that will be done in practice, we have to yet see. It's my intention that the Jefferson County masking ordinance will expire at the same time that they the other ones do around the state. San Juan and King County are going to be ending theirs as well, kind of in phase with the state's reopening plan. And I just have to reiterate my strong advice to people that are unvaccinated. As we make this change in the state, it's going to make things less safe for people who are unvaccinated. As fewer people are wearing masks, as indoor events become more crowded, the risk is going to go up. So I urge anyone who's made the decision not to get vaccinated to revisit that decision over and over again. And we have vaccine available. So we can walk-in vaccination is available at several sites around the county. And we're never going to give up on trying to get people vaccinated.
So one tiny follow-up question. What's the intel on booster shots? A couple people have asked me about booster shots.
There's a lot of research being done on that. The variants really factor into that because for some of the variants, you need high antibody levels. And one of the ways you keep your antibody levels high is with booster shots. So I think boosters are coming. It's probably going to be at 1 year after your first dose, but it could be sooner than that. Especially for frontline medical providers. It could be as early as 9 months after the first dose. And we're not that far away from it. We started vaccinating medical providers in mid-December. So we could see booster doses. And what we're really waiting for, though, the best booster dose would be a reformulated vaccine that contains protection against some of the variants in it. So they've developed these, they're testing them, but from a public health standpoint, we are doing sort of the groundwork to be prepared if a booster dose comes out that we can, you know, get it into people's arms quickly. It's one of the reasons we're not dismantling the drive-through vaccination site. We want it available in the future if we need to use it.
Thank you.
I ask one follow-up too to that, Dr. Locke. Do you anticipate the Department of Health or the LNI guidance for after June 30th to include any language about distancing?
I'm sorry, that I didn't catch that last word. Language about
distancing. Do you think we'll continue to suggest distancing for the unvaccinated?
Yes, I believe that distancing will still be part of the protocols. It is now, distancing matters. Even with airborne, distancing is crucial for what we call droplet transmission. Most heavy droplets settle out in about 3 feet from the person who emits them. But in airborne infection, which we now think that's the predominant way that COVID is spread, it can go further, but it's diluted. You know, with each additional foot of distance, you have less virus in the air. So I think for the unvaccinated, they both masking and distancing, with 6 feet sort of being the target distance. Now that doesn't mean that it has to be 6 feet 100% of the time. You know, masked individuals can come closer than that for short periods. But it's in terms of where desk spacing and layout of indoor spaces, yeah, that still will be required. So distancing requirements are only going away for the fully vaccinated.
The vaccinated hugs are okay right now.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Great.
As long as they're consensual.
Great. Hey, do you want to move on to KPTZ questions?
Okay, there was one just asking about a city council candidates forum planned for July 17th, and will in-person events like this be possible? And the answer is definitely yes. The full capacity indoor events will be allowed with the requirements that we were just talking about. That is to say, the unvaccinated still need to abide by masking and distancing, but for the fully vaccinated, that's not an issue. There was a question that asked, is information available about the incidence of long COVID in vaccinated persons who get a breakthrough infection? The answer to that is no. That is such a rare event now, that breakthrough infections, that we, you know, we don't have enough cases to draw any conclusion. Although generally in breakthrough infections, the infection is much milder than it otherwise would be. 50% of breakthrough infections are asymptomatic, but around 10% can be severe infections and result in hospitalization. We do have more and more information about long COVID in the population at large. So people who have had actual COVID infection. There was just a big report on this, a national report published about a week ago, and its estimate was across the board, 23% of people who have COVID have some residual symptoms after 5 weeks. And it varies with how severe your infection was. So people who had severe infection and were in the hospital, it's up to 50% of them have residual symptoms. And the most common is fatigue, cognitive problems that you know, what people often think of as brain fog, trouble concentrating, shortness of breath, chest pain, loss of taste are the main things we're seeing in long COVID. But the profound fatigue and exercise intolerance is probably one of the worst. And we're seeing this in children too. Up to 15% of children who have symptomatic COVID will have some persistent symptoms after 6 weeks. It's an unusual virus infection in that sense. Most viruses we get, you know, when it's over, it's over. We don't have residual symptoms from it, but COVID is an unfortunate exception to that rule. There was a question that asked why some people are more susceptible than others to getting COVID, and I think the question was also suggesting, you know, maybe it works the other way too. Do we really understand ways of preventing the infection other than vaccination? And we think mostly that everybody who's not been immunized or has not had prior infection is susceptible. And it's mostly a matter of behavior and luck. You know, whether you become infected or not. That is to say, the luck in the sense of whether you actually get exposed to the virus. But health status does make a difference. People who are healthy and well-rested and well-nourished have less severe disease, are probably more likely to have asymptomatic or mild cases. And it's just because their immune system is working better. Other than general health measures, we don't really know how to boost immune function. The various vitamins and nutritional supplements, none of them are proven to actually improve immune function, but some really basic things. And probably most significantly, sleep patterns. Poor sleep habits have a profound effect on immune status. So if people are to work on anything, that's what I would work on. Also, regular exercise and nutritious diet appear to be important. So if you want to prevent COVID by non-vaccination means, that's your best bet. My recommendation is you do both. You know, good sleep, exercise, nutrition, and vaccination. That's where you're going to get the highest protection. Then there was a question asking if we're counting positive home tests, and we are. If people inform us of the home test, and it's in a situation where it's probable that it is a true infection, we're counting that as a probable. Under the state classification, confirmed cases mean that you had the gold standard test, the PCR test. But we think the home test is actually a highly accurate test, and especially among people who have risk factors for infection. Say they have a known exposure, or they have symptoms consistent with COVID-19. And then the final questions were asking about loosening of requirements for the Mountain View pool, similar to the Y and Squim and the Shore Pool in Port Angeles. And actually those restrictions are state-based. So the states has restrictions for public pools for phase 1, 2, and 3. And so we're now in phase 3, which allows all pools to be open, but at a reduced capacity standard. At around 50%, and different pools are achieving that in different ways. Most of them I know are using a kind of a reservation system, but it's really to control the number of people in the building at one time. And all of that's going to go away at the end of this month or maybe sooner. But it's not something that we regulate at a local level. What public health does with pools at a local level has to do with water quality, just making sure that they have the right kind of disinfection systems and that the water is safe to be in. But we don't do COVID regulation and for pools or spas or you know, recreational water parks or any of those things. So, and I think that's it for the KPTZ questions.
Great, thank you. Anything else for Dr. Locke before we move on to Willie? Okay, and Willie Benz, Director of Emergency Management, is here with us by phone. Welcome, Willie.
Hello and good morning. So for us, after a comparatively kind of quiet week last week, our vaccine operations team is going to have a pretty busy end of the week this week with a couple of clinics on the schedule. First, I had mentioned last week that we'll be at the Tri-Area Food Bank this coming Wednesday from 9:30 to 2. So we'll be out there looking to offer that up to both food bank customers, as well as again, anyone who wants the vaccine, who's in the area, who that'll be convenient for. So again, 9:30 to 2 at the Tri-Area Food Bank. With this particular clinic and the rest of our clinics, we're offering both Moderna as well as Johnson & Johnson. So if you want the one and done J&J, that's an option for you. But if you'd rather get a little bit more protection by getting the two dose vaccine series, that is an option for you as well. Also with this clinic, as with the rest of our clinics on the schedule, you can sign up for an appointment by either going to the public health website or calling our call center at 344-9791. Or walk-ins are welcome as well. Appointments are a little bit easier for us, but if you want to walk in, we certainly aren't going to be turning anyone away. So walk-ins are welcome as well for that. So we'll be at the food bank on Wednesday. Then at Friday, we will actually be at Sunrise Cafe right there by the boatyard. We'll be there from 3 to 7. Friday evening. And that's really specifically to try to target folks who work there in the yard, who are coming off work, who might not have had an opportunity to get the shot. You know, during working hours, they might have been concerned about having to take time off work, dealing with side effects. So we're doing it Friday evening, again, to get folks coming off work. They have the weekend coming up so they can take that weekend to recuperate if needed, if they do experience any side effects. And yeah, again, really trying to target a specific population. But additionally, that one is open to anyone and everyone as well. Like the other clinic, you can sign up for an appointment beforehand. Walk-ins are welcome on top of that. And we will also be offering both Moderna and Johnson & Johnson at that clinic. Last but certainly not least, then we'll be at the Farmers Market in Port Townsend again the following day on Saturday the 26th. We'll be out there from 10 to 1. And again, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, appointments encouraged, but walk-ins welcome. And we were at the Farmers Market just a couple of weeks ago. We saw a decent turnout. We had 10 walk-ins as well as a couple of appointments scheduled on top of that. And we're really hoping that, you know, when we were there a few weeks ago, the weather was a little bit overcast. There was a light drizzle. And this weekend's shaping up to be a much sunnier, nicer one. So we're hoping for a good turnout there. I'm hoping to, again, have a few more folks come out, get the vaccine, check out the farmer's market, et cetera. So, again, hoping for a good turnout there. So those are our three clinics coming up just this week. As always, as I've mentioned before, we're still in the process of trying to collect some final data, target our last couple of clinics. We are next on our schedule is to schedule one on a Sunday for folks to get the people who might work 5 or 6 days a week and have busy schedules, get folks who are, you know, coming out of maybe a Sunday morning church service, et cetera. So expect one of those scheduled coming up. But in the meantime, there are, as I've mentioned before, lots of options, lots of walk-in options available at our local pharmacies, at Jefferson Healthcare through their Express Clinic, et cetera. So you can see all those on the public health website or again at our call center at 344-9791. Speaking of the call center, one of our KPTZ questions did ask how long we plan to continue operations of that service. And at this point in time, we plan to go through at least the end of July. I know with a lot of folks with the many parts of the economy and many restrictions going away July 1st, I know the feeling was that we might close it June 30th, but we want to keep it open at least through July as things start opening up. Well, we're still encouraging, you know, vaccination through these pop-up clinics, et cetera. And specifically, we know that there's some confusion with the new testing landscape. So we're currently working on some guidance and we'll have some more information about how to get tested, where to find testing, et cetera. And we want our call center to be able to support that. So we'll be open through at least July. We'll make a determination near the end of July to see if there's still a need for it at that time. I'm fully willing to keep that call center open as long as there is a need for it in the community. At this point in time, though, we're only getting a couple of calls a day, but we still want to be able to address those questions and concerns and scheduling needs. So, yeah, call center will be open at least through the end of July. The other KPTZ question for me was a question about our volunteer numbers. And so we only have everything calculated through mid-April. So we have May and you know, we're a little over halfway through June. But through mid-April, we have a total of 308 individuals who've helped us out in our COVID response, 65 of which are medical personnel. So those doctors, nurses, et cetera, that have helped us with vaccination efforts, and a total of 7 who have been volunteering since the very beginning, since March of 2020, who've been helping us out in the Emergency Operations Center. So a bunch of folks who've come forward from the community and have helped at all sorts of varying levels, but definitely a very special shout out to those 7 who've been with us for almost a year and a half, volunteering their time in the response. Through mid-April, we had a grand total of 6,247 hours volunteered officially. Those are our fully documented and accounted for hours, but there were kind of lots on the perimeter here and there, you know, webinars attended, conference calls attended, other research, that kind of fun stuff. So that's just an official total. And under the FEMA reimbursable rate for Washington State for volunteer work, that accounts for just a little under $200,000 worth of monetary value donated to the county by our volunteer workforce. Through the end of June, our volunteer coordinator estimates that we'll probably have somewhere near 8,000 hours volunteered, and that value would be at about 253,000 hours. So again, just an absolute magnificent lift by our community. We're really appreciative of all the folks who've come forward and donated their time and their skill set. It always amazes me, the folks who come here to Jefferson County to retire and then don't want to sit still and sit idly by during a pandemic, and the skills and the experiences and the knowledge they've brought forth have been irreplaceable. So a huge thank you to those hundreds of people who stepped up and volunteered. A thank you to the folks who did come forward and were on our volunteer lists and who may have, for one reason or another, not been able to actually volunteer at the Jefferson Healthcare drive-through clinic, maybe weren't able to make it to one of our mass vaccination clinics, but still stepped forward and were available. So huge thank you to everyone. We are wrapping things up, and the need for volunteers has rapidly decreased over the past couple of months. But
well, I'll just add my thanks to the volunteers as well. It's really been extraordinary that the effort that they've made, and we couldn't have done it without them. We've had volunteers working as case investigators too at the health department, which we deeply appreciate.
Yeah, we should maybe try to plan some sort of thank you for them officially. Dr. Locke, I wonder if maybe I was going to ask Willie this, but could you talk about the change in testing with Jefferson Healthcare closing down their drive-through testing, because that's coming up this week? Maybe let folks know where they can be looking for information on testing.
Right. So that is a shift. Although the testing volumes are down at the drive-through testing facility in Port Townsend, it's still being used, and it will. The plan is, the hospital's plan is to discontinue it at the end of this month, or on the 28th, I think, is the official day. And at that point, Jefferson Health, first of all, Jefferson Healthcare will still be offering testing in their clinics and their urgent care and the emergency room. And for so people who have a Jefferson Healthcare provider who think they need to be tested should contact that provider. For those that don't, we're keeping a list of testing resources on our website. And increasingly, testing is moving to the home arena. So home tests for COVID are now readily available at a number of stores. We've been using those when we test contacts who are in quarantine. We're now using home testing as the technology for doing that. There's other kinds of home tests that you can get from including some at no cost, where the lab sends the specimen container to you and then you send it back to them. Those are increasingly available. And then other counties, our neighboring counties at the pharmacies, they have testing at Rite Aid and Walgreens and CVS. That are becoming the major ways that people get tests in those counties. Unfortunately, we don't have those kind of pharmacies in Jefferson County. So we're working with the state to try to get some kind of equivalent access. But that's a work in progress. We would like to have something similar to what Clallam and Kitsap has in terms of pharmacy-based testing. And then finally, there are private clinics that offer testing as well. But the starting point always is if you're affiliated with a clinic, either in county or out of county, you start with them, and they can help triage, see if you really do need testing or not before you actually pursue it.
Great, thank you. Looks like Willie's trying to join, but having some trouble. Dr. Luck, do you know, he listed a number of opportunities for vaccination, but none of them included the Pfizer vaccine, which is necessary for the 12 to 17 year olds. Do you know if that's something that Jefferson Healthcare has on hand for their patients, or would you recommend other non-Jefferson Healthcare patients go out of county for that, or?
Right now, the availability of the Pfizer vaccine is three places, Jefferson Healthcare, and then QSC Pharmacy in Hadlock, and also Tri-Area Pharmacy. Okay. I believe QSC, it's by appointment. At Tri-Area Pharmacy, they're offering walk-in Pfizer vaccinations. It's a trickier vaccine to store and prepare. So it does not lend itself to the kind of portable pop-ups we're doing. But we're open. We have done some pop-ups in schools using the Pfizer vaccine, and we'll continue to do that. We're always we have ample supplies of Pfizer vaccine in Jefferson County, so it is available, but it's trickier to administer because of the ultra cold holding temperatures that you keep it at.
Thank you. Well, it's since we have our DNR, okay, Greg, and then we should be kind of brief, we do have our DNR guests here, but go ahead.
I'll be quick. I just want to throw out props to all the volunteers that have kept us safe as well. I mean, it's, you know, you guys have talked about DEM and Jefferson Healthcare and contact tracing, and it's also the normal extraordinary volunteer corps that we have and the food banks that have kept food access going strong. And you know, our Echo has 10 times the amount of rides that other comparable counties do. So, I mean, it's been a real strength throughout this. So I want to say thank you. And then I guess this is a question for Willie, but I'm just wondering if we're working with churches to actually provide them at the churches on you know, after services. And I'm just encouraging that kind of close contact with the where we want to go.
I can answer that. Yeah, very much so. We've been doing that, and we think faith leaders are real, because of the trust relationships they formed with their clergy, are really good ambassadors for vaccination too. So we are working with all the different denominations, and we're very open to providing vaccination, you know, following church services.
Great. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Locke. And looks like we had some tech issues with Willie, but appreciate both of your time every Monday.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And a recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thank you for listening. Thank you to the commissioners. Thank you, Dr. Locke. And thank you, Willie Bentz. Thank you all. Here on the first day of summer.